pro-choice liberal feminazi slut Rush Limbaugh warned you about. It's Start Me Up.
Start Me Up.
With Kimberly A. Johnson.
Hello, it is December 13th. No, 14th. I keep thinking it's the 13th, 2016. So I'm just going to get right into this about my... I'm a little pissed. Can you imagine? Kimberly's pissed again. Well, the reason I'm upset is because... okay, there's so many things swirling through my mind. Okay, this is what it is. Bernie Sanders did a... I'm going to talk about this more on a show later, but I'm going to touch on it now because I'm going to go into another subject. So here's the deal. Bernie Sanders did a town hall with Trump voters with Chris Hayes the other night. And there were some media outlets that focused in on one of his comments about PC culture, and they basically focused on it in a negative way. And it really pissed me off because I have the quote that Bernie said on my wall... and it just goes to show you what's wrong with the way that we're handling this election. We're handling the candidates, even though he's no longer a candidate, but Bernie was a candidate. And it really pisses me off because instead of focusing on the really important things, like the fact that Russia is meddling with our, not just our elections, but with our country, we're all getting bent out of shape because fucking Bernie Sanders said something about PC culture that all the PC people didn't like. It just makes me angry. Again, I'm gonna have audio and stuff to prove my point on my next show. But how I'm going to talk about it now is that I think that everybody recognize that this is Kimberly's conspiracy theory corner. So it's put on your tinfoil hat time. I'm not saying anything that, you know, what I'm saying here is not absolute. I'm not speaking as an expert. I'm speaking as a citizen who is taking a look at everything, feeling a little paranoid and wondering what's going on. So I think that, you know, since we've got this evidence from the CIA, which we don't have yet, but they're saying they have evidence that the Russians have interfered with our elections, I think that it's totally within reason to wonder if the Russians had anything to do with planting people to create a division in the Democratic Party between Democratic voters. So you look at, there was the whole Bernie bot situation, and then there were the, you know, the Hill bots, the Bernie bots versus the Hill bots. And so, you know, yeah, there were a lot of legitimate condescending jerks online that were for Bernie or for Hillary. But perhaps some of that condescension, some of that division and anger was put into place because there were plants there. So, you know, if you take a look at what these Bernie bot, you know, there were the argument from the Hillary people, which I don't even like the term bot, but I'm just using it to prove a point. Some of the Hillary people, some of the Hillary supporters were saying, oh, these Bernie bots are very misogynistic. And of course, you know, I saw myself, there were misogynistic comments coming from these Bernie people. And I'm not saying that all of them were fake, but how do you know that all of these so-called Bernie bots were legitimate people and not plants, whether it was from the Republican Party, whether it was from Russia or whatever, we're so quick to get our, get upset when we see something and take it for face value. And for example, sometimes when I post something, right, like I'll post an article or I'll post a long rant, and then somebody comes on who I don't know and they make a comment. I'll read this comment and maybe that comment will make me go, oh my God, I'm cringing at what I wrote now because I offended this person or whatever it is. Then I click on the link that takes me to their profile. And I look at them and I realize that they're just some person. I don't want to take anything away from them, but they're just some voice out in the middle of the country that I don't know. And who the hell knows what their story is? And maybe they didn't like what I said, or, you know, maybe they said something to me that I initially questioned. But once I kind of realized that they're just one little voice out there like me, that, you know, one person's opinion, it doesn't mean that they represent everybody in the country. That's just one person. And so we, as people on Facebook who are commenting and seeing what other people say, I think are getting too influenced by what could possibly be plants. And then this, you know, this whole divide gives the media a story to latch onto. And even though the primary is over and the general election is over, I'm still seeing this blame game going on, that it was all this, like, it's all the reason that the election was lost because Hillary was a bad candidate, or because Bernie made it possible for the Russians to, you know, hack in. And it's all bullshit. I just wish everybody would chill. You know, stop reacting, stop having a knee-jerk reaction and playing into this, because you may be being, you know, you might be their pawn. Don't give in. I can say that I have bought some of it. Now I'm going to make an effort. I'm going to make an effort not to have that knee-jerk reaction. I'm going to make an effort not to assume that just because some asshole supposedly from our side of the fence says something, that I'm going to quickly assume that we have to divide from them. So, you know, I'm really pissed off about this, as you can see, and I'm going to go into this whole thing next week on my own about PC culture, and I'm gonna use the example that what Bernie was talking about on the Chris Hayes show. But I'm just asking everybody who's listening to this to just chill out a little bit and stop taking the bait. Cool? Will you do that? Oh, anyway. So the next thing I'm going to say before I get in to the interview with my guest, Stacey Greeson, is what I would like to see from, whether it's Democratic progressive organizations, high profile celebrities, is I'd like to see a united front against this new administration, just like we saw with the Republican Party when Obama was nominated or was inaugurated. Their first goal was to make him a one-term president. They promised that they would obstruct. So I believe this is how Democrats need to handle the current administration, because this is not even just about Democrat versus Republican. This is a whole new ball game. This is now very upsetting and very disturbing, because we don't really understand how much Russia has to do with this win. And aside from just the win, Trump's win, how far they've gotten in. And it's totally clear that no matter what the Russians want to do, the American people have made it easy for them, because the American people are arguing with each other. They're not paying attention to the bigger picture. They're falling for fake news stories. They're not focusing on the really important stuff. They're focusing on the little things that are easy to get angry at, and there is no real big solution for it. I think we need to take a united front. I'd like to see more Democratic leaders behave with and hold hands with and stand with, you know, like Elizabeth Warren, who is not afraid to call Donald Trump out. And I'd like to see more Democratic leaders talking to the voters and saying, you have to stand up for your rights as a citizen. You have to go out there and peacefully protest. I'd like to see people like Oprah Winfrey, Beyonce. I'd like to see organizations like Planned Parenthood, which they are. Planned Parenthood is absolutely taking a resistance stance. But I'd like to see it as a coalition. I'd like for there to be, for whoever's listening out there, I don't know if you are listening, but I would really like to see that happen. So if you're just a ordinary average citizen like me, one thing that you can do is contact your lawmakers and ask them to do this. Ask them to stand up against the Trump administration and not to fear it. Because as we saw in 2014, when Democratic officials, you know, leaders, whatever, House of Representatives, senators, local and state, when they refused to stand up for Obama and for Obamacare, they lost. So right now, and if you take a look, whether you like Bernie Sanders or not, this is not the point, so please don't get caught up on that. His message resonated just as Elizabeth Warren's message. It resonates with people. We love to see strong leaders who are standing up against the discrimination, the bigotry, the racism. We love that. And it inspires us, and it gives us energy, and it makes a big difference in how things are perceived, whether it's through the media or just the general feeling in the country. So I encourage everybody to whether it's, you know, sending tweets to Oprah Winfrey or contacting your local and federally, you know, like the federal reps, the local reps, contact them, let them know you want them to stand up. You want them to have a backbone. And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm just, I think I've said in prior podcasts that I feel like I'm all over the place. And I realized last night why that is. The reason I feel like I'm all over the place is because I feel like everything I'm thinking right now is a conspiracy. Everything I'm thinking, could, you know, get people to believe that I'm some crazy, you know, leftist conspiracy theorist. So I'm afraid to voice what I really feel or what I feel in any particular moment, because I don't know if anybody's ever going to take me seriously. But the truth of the matter is I don't know the details. I can only go on what I'm seeing out in the world, whether it's on the news or in articles that I'm seeing online. And everything that I see scares me. I don't feel confident that the Democratic Party has my back yet. I have mixed feelings about Nancy Pelosi as House Minority Leader, because I like Nancy Pelosi. Don't get me wrong. I think she's awesome. But I don't know that she's the right person for this, because is she going to stand up to Trump and understand that this is a different ballgame? This is not just like dealing with the Bush administration. This is completely different. So unless she brings something new to the table, unless she brings that fighting spirit to the table, you know, I won't be convinced necessarily that she is our best choice. I'm not writing her off. I'm just keeping my fingers crossed. Anyway, so there's my rant. And I mean, as we move forward and as this, I don't even want to go to the Trump administration yet, because I'm hoping that a miracle happens beforehand. I know that that's not necessarily likely, but I'm still going to hope, because it's not yet December 19th and we still don't know for sure exactly what the electors are going to do. We don't know what's going to happen on Inauguration Day. So until we know for sure, I'm going to have some hope. You know, I will continue to formulate and evolve on my opinions, and clearly I'll let you know for those who are listening or read my Facebook posts. And last, I would like to offer a big thank you to Leslie Selzillow for interviewing me in Daily Kos. She wrote up an article and interviewed me, and it's called Feminist Rights Book on Teen Abortion to Reduce Sexist and Deceptive Stigma by Right-Wing Extremists. So I gave her some input and feedback, or, you know, my thoughts on my book, Peyton's Choice, about teen abortion. And I thank her for sharing it all over and helping me out, because that was completely awesome. And before I introduce my guest, Stacy, it's time to do my little advertisements here. So asking you to support my show, Start Me Up. It's a great way to support me and what I'm doing. You can become a monthly subscriber at patreon.com/startmeup. And you can either do $1 a month, or you could do $5 a month. If you pledge $5 a month, you get to listen to the after show, which is called End Another Thing. It's a little segment after the free show. And then if you pledge $10 a month, you'll get access to a free bonus third show with either a special guest or just me ranting and raving. I'll probably be a little inappropriate. I won't be politically correct, and I'll cuss a lot. So there's that. So I'm excited about my guest, because her name is Stacy Greeson, and she refers to herself as a recovered soap star. And it was funny, because when I asked her about how she wanted to be introduced, she wrote recovered soap star, and then in parentheses she wrote, seriously, it was only 3.5 years, a million years ago, that she was on Days of Our Lives. She played Isabella Toscano, Izzy B., and I was a fan of the show, so I'm very familiar with her work. She played opposite Drake Hogeston, which was John Black, and I found her online. I believe it was around 2010 or 2011, and she's also an author. So she wrote The Last Great American Housewife, which is on Amazon. She has written for the Huffington Post, Brevity, Slate, and she's also a coach for fellow writers at The Right Muse. So that's Write, like W-R-I-T-E, Write Muse. You might want to check her out. She's pretty interesting, but she's going to come on and we're going to talk about a lot of different subjects. We're both going to talk about our writing experiences. We're going to touch on feminism, sexism in Hollywood, and even a little bit about Donald Trump. And then afterward, another thing, we're going to talk about the fact that we're both in some awesome, serious relationships. So please, 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 please welcome Stacey Greeson. And welcome Stacey Greeson, the recovering soap star turned writer. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So you said this was your first podcast.
This is my first time doing a podcast. I'm a big podcast listener.
Uh-huh.
I love, I started listening to WTF right when Marc Maron started his podcast.
Uh-huh, that's a great one.
And then podcasting grew more popular. You know, now I listen to everything from Fresh Air to Keeping It 1600 to... I love to listen to podcasts, yeah.
When you listen to podcasts, do you just like... house clean, drive? What are you doing when you're listening?
Until recently, I was hiking.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved in with my fiance and his kids, and I moved from the mountains to the ocean. So there's no hiking at the ocean. So now I listen and cycle.
Oh, that's cool.
It's a good break for your mind from writing. It's a good break for my mind from writing. And I love podcasts because they're story. It's almost always a story. It's, you know, expanding my mind.
Yeah. I got the inspiration to do this podcast because I listened to the Marc Maron interview with Jeff Goldblum. And I just thought, I think I can do that. I mean, obviously, I know that I have a ways to go, but it just sounded like it was fun. It was fun listening to that conversation. And so that was my inspiration.
My best girlfriend, Linda, and I used to talk on the phone every day for an hour. And I said, why isn't this just a podcast?
Yeah, really? Exactly. And that's how I like to think of at least my particular podcast. It's almost like a phone conversation, whether it's between friends or just two different people who have some interesting experiences to share. So I want to start off letting everybody know that both of us worked on Days of Our Lives. You were a star. You played... Isabella Toscano, Izzy B, and I started watching Days of Our Lives when I was 9 years old. And so I, you know, was your fan and a fan of the show. And so the funny story is that, you know, I before I even decided to get into acting, I worked at a store which is now called, it's now Macy's, but it was the Glendale Macy's and it used to be called the Broadway. So at the time, a lot of people who worked on Days of Our Lives, like Drake Hogeston and a couple other famous stars from the show, would come in. And then I also worked with people in the at the perfume counter who worked on the show. Then my mother was an extra on the show. And then later on, we both my mother and I attended an acting studio, and we got the casting director, Fran Bascom, to come in to our studio. And it was really cool because pretty much everybody from my acting studio got hired and worked on the show. But my mom got the most work. And then I was probably number two as far as getting, you know, I was on for like 7 years. We were both on for 7 years. She played the late Joe Mascolo, Stefano De Mira. I heard he passed away and I was so sad because he was so cool. But she played his maid, Eliana. And I just played a police officer. But you and I never actually met. We became friends on Facebook. And so I just think it's funny because when I found you on Facebook, I saw that you were also a writer. And so before we get into that, explain to me what you mean by being a recovered soap star.
The thing is, when I think about it, it's like I'm still contacted by people who say, I knew you when you were on Days of Our Lives, but that was 20 years ago.
Wow.
And I was only on the show for 3.5 years.
But you made such a big impact.
So the interesting thing is that, well, I see it more as it's the only thing I ever really did in public.
Right.
So, I'm a whatever happened to story. But the recovered soap star thing for me was that in my early 20s, I got this acting job that catapulted me into a different life. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, everyone's using the term bubble now, right? So it catapulted me into this stratosphere where I made a good living doing what I loved. It was so much fun. Mm-hmm. But it was also so much work.
Yeah.
And internally, I wasn't mature enough yet to handle that kind of responsibility. Not in the sense of alcohol or drugs or leaving a marriage like a lot of people do when they get successful, when they get external fame. But I was not mature enough. I didn't have a high enough self-esteem to handle that kind of challenge.
Yeah.
And so after a while, I just became so tired of doing it, combating the, you know, being in front of the camera all the time. I didn't enjoy it.
Yeah.
And people bothering me were coming up to me in, you know, bathrooms and at mm-hmm. dinner. Even though I was grateful, it was that thing, you know, life is not black and white. It was good and it was bad, mm-hmm. like everything. But at the same time, I had started writing in my dressing room, and I had started doing all these little writing exercises from that Julia Cameron book, The Artist's Way.
Yes, I have that book.
Right. And I discovered I have a voice. And I think the thing about acting was it was so necessary for me at a time in my life, in my teenage years, when I was a person who couldn't translate her big feelings. And acting in a small mountain town, a small, very conservative white mountain town in Colorado. And I was so different, and acting gave me an avenue of expression for all of my feelings. And then as I matured, I started discovering that I didn't want to just say other people's words. Mm-hmm. I actually had a voice mm-hmm. and I had things I wanted to say. And I loved writing. It didn't require me to stand in front of anyone, to look a certain way. And, you know, there was also, I know we had talked about, you know, I want to talk today. There is also just that double standard in Hollywood that's getting so much better. But at the time, I was 26 years old and people were telling me already that it was time to have my eyes done.
Oh my God.
And I felt like I was working so hard on building a greater sense of myself. And I thought, I'm not going to make it to 30 if I stay. I'm not going to make it to 40 at all.
Right.
And feel good about myself. You know, I just was a person who didn't want to have plastic surgery. I know a lot of women now on daytime TV have to have a lot of things done. And it's fine if people want to have it done. But I knew that I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to live under those conditions. And so, you know, I left the show, and it was really, so recovering soap star means that I was so young. So I left the show and I decided I'm going to go back to college and finish my degree and become a writer. And I went and visited, my mother went with me, and we visited all these campuses across the country that had these great writing programs. And I had a real career, and I couldn't figure out how to go back to college. At the time, it was so different. Now people go to college online, they do, but this was a long time ago. I couldn't figure out how to go back and fit in with these kids.
Yeah.
I felt so much older, even though in reality I was like 6 years older, 7 years mm-hmm. older than the kids. Mm-hmm. So when I had the realization that I couldn't go back, I couldn't figure out how to move forward. So I just moved to a guest house in Topanga Canyon on 10 acres. And I wrote for a year. And then I started going out on auditions again because I realized that people have to have jobs.
Yeah, you have to eat.
That's so funny. I don't know. I wrote this piece about it that was published in Jane magazine called Always the Drunken Bridesmaid. And I realized it was like, I think I literally thought that I could just go from being a soap opera star to making that living as a writing poetry, really bad poetry. And thank goodness I thought that, or I never would have left the soap, right?
Yeah.
So it took me a long time to, being on TV is hard work, but also it's kind of a, it, it's kind of shiny. There's a little bit of a shiny life sense to it. Mm-hmm. And then you just go back to real life when you're not doing that anymore. And real life is awesome. It was just a hard balance because people were still recognizing me from the show. And yet I was trying to be a writer. I was trying to distance myself from that part of myself. It was very confusing. And, you know, I mean, on a scale of life problems, this is not a problem. But it just required a lot of internal growth. And then shortly after that, I got very ill. And I was ill for about 15 years. So that plunged me into a whole new territory, you know. And so it wasn't very pretty, and I didn't do the transition very well. But I did write a lot, and I wound up writing 3 novels in my 30s. Wow. So that's the good thing about being ill, is you really have downtime.
Oh, wow. Well, there's so much I want to ask you. But before I even start asking you the questions about your book, I just want to throw in there my experience. When you said that you were young and you didn't have the maturity to handle what was happening to you, I was certainly not a star. I played a police officer. I had 5 lines or less. Occasionally, I had more than 5 lines. But I understood the pressure because I'm 6 feet tall and I'm not skinny. I'm slender, or I was slender at the time, and you know, but my build was, I have big bones, I take a size 11 shoe, and I'm not a small person. So when I walked on to the set of Days of Our Lives, even though it was like for the very first time, it was so awesome for me because I recognized everybody and I didn't really feel like I was in this strange universe. I felt like I was in this world that I had been a part of since I was 9 years old. But what I noticed and felt was, for the people who don't know this, when you're hired like I was to be on the show, you get a dressing room that usually belongs to one of the regular stars who were off that day. So there were many times that I would get a dressing room that belonged to one of the women stars, and their clothes would be in there, and their clothes were like a size 0, and I would look at them and I would just feel so awful about myself. I would always just feel so fat, and I just didn't feel like I was at all like anybody on that show. I felt like an alien. So I can completely relate to what you're talking about. And even though my experience on that show was so awesome and so wonderful, it's like you said, there's never a black and white. There's always some kind of gray area. And when you're dealing with, you know, Hollywood, it's like you said, there's plastic surgery, there's so much pressure on women to appear a certain way, and it's really tough if you're not ready to give into that. And you know, I mean, I wasn't going to become an anorexic, I wasn't going to cut my face open, so you know, I mean, kudos to you for recognizing that in yourself and leaving. And so that brings me to now the book that you that's on Amazon, is that your first book? That's the Last Great American Housewife. Was that your first book?
No, that was my third.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So the first novel that I wrote, I finished, I think, when I was about 32. And the title is Job's Daughter. And I sent it out. I got an agent within like 3 weeks. And I didn't understand anything, of course, about the publishing business. And so 2 weeks after, I left her a message like, what's happening with the book? And when she didn't call me back for 2 weeks, I fired her. Not realizing that, like, the publishing industry is the opposite of the acting industry. You go on an audition on Monday, you know, by Friday, if you've got the guest spot, right? So, and you're always at your agent, you and your agent are always in contact. You're getting calls for auditions. So I fired her. So then I went on and wrote another book. And my second novel, the interesting thing, my second novel, the title is It's Not Unusual. I finished that about 15 years ago, so in my mid-30s. And about when I was about 35, 36 years old, I finished It's Not Unusual. So it's the story of two lonely people in Los Angeles who don't know each other in the beginning of the book. And halfway through, they join a survivalist cult in the desert called Take Back America. And I recently, my fiance said, whatever happened, and it was almost published right before 9/11. Huh. And then 9/11 happened and the publisher dropped it. They just said it's too, I mean, these people become basically American terrorists.
Yeah.
And 9/11 was not the time that you want to put out a book about that. So the book got dropped. And I moved on and wrote my next novel, The Last Great American Housewife. So recently my fiance said, whatever happened to that novel? It seems a little like Make America Great Again. And I thought, oh my gosh, that's so true. So I went back and I started reading it. And I was shocked that the characters are talking about how, you know, people who don't look like them are taking over the city and having to learn another language. And it was about corporate America taking, you know, destroying their lives. And I was absolutely shocked. And so I sent it out and it's actually starting to get some,
oh, wow,
good feelings right now. So right. I'm thinking this is such an important lesson mm-hmm. as you get older in life that I wish somehow I could impart on my younger friends. I try all the time, but I feel like it just falls on deaf ears.
I know what you mean.
You know what? Nothing is ever wasted in life. And sometimes it just takes a long time.
Yeah.
So right when I was younger, like Job's Daughter, the first novel, I just shelved it. Nobody wants it. I wrote another book. Oh, you know, it gets dropped by the publisher. Shelve it. Keep going. You know, and it's only recently that, you know, I just had a short story I finished in my 30s published. Hmm. I pulled it out again. I reworked it. And it came out last week in a literary journal called Lunch Ticket out of Antioch University.
Oh, wow.
So you start to learn as you get older, if you develop wisdom, it's like there's no such thing as losing if you just keep taking action.
Yeah, you just keep going. You just keep putting it out there. That's absolutely
exactly.
true. So how do you think being an actress informed your writing? How did that help you?
Well, don't you think as an actress also that it... You being an actor is learning to live in the shoes of another, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
Being literally in the skin of another.
Mm-hmm.
So you're developing a voice and everything. So it's very, writing and acting is imagine as if. Mm-hmm. So I think they're so similar. So for me, it's always about finding the voice of the central character or characters. And once mm-hmm. I have the voice, then I just go.
Let me ask you this, and I'll just present you with how it is for me anyway. When I come up, I've only written one fiction book called Peyton's Choice, and that's about a teen who has an abortion. And the idea that I decided to write that book came from the fact that, you know, the news, the fact that I'm a feminist online and I'm always writing about this stuff and recognizing that rights are being taken away. So I just wanted to write something that would give young women, I wanted to focus on female empowerment, but I also wanted to let them know that, you know, if there's a teenager out there that gets pregnant and wants to choose abortion, that it's not the worst thing, that they're not a bad person. And so I got the idea one day, just, you know, I was like laying in bed, taking a nap and thinking and this and that. And the idea came to me and I felt inspired and I felt motivated to write it. And so I had that like inner motivation. So I want to ask you, like, how do you come to figure out what kind of story you're going to write? And then when I write it, I just start. I don't have an outline or anything. I have an idea, and then the story just kind of shapes itself as I'm writing it. So I'm wondering, like, what inspires you, and how does it come, you know, like, how do you get an idea for something or whatever? Like, how do you decide on what to write? And then do you have an outline, or is it like a free flow thing?
Well, my ideas, this sounds so funny, but it's true. Characters just come to me.
Mm-hmm.
So for The Last Great American Housewife, my novel that's on Amazon, I was lying in bed one night and I couldn't fall asleep. And this voice said, the last time I saw my mother alive, she was standing out of Ahab's all-night mart, a 63-year-old heartache.
Hmm.
And I was like, who is that? So I just started writing about her, and I just started writing about this person who was driving in the rain looking for her mother who had early onset Alzheimer's and had escaped yet again from assisted living.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned into a book about these kids who try to save the world from, climate change, the world is ending. And I gave it to my writing mentor, the amazing writer Jim Crusoe, and he read the first draft of the novel. It was like 450 pages, and he said, the only character I like is the housewife with the mother. And I was like, oh boy. So then I went back and just started exploring it. But I don't have an outline either. I have no idea where I'm headed with the rough draft. I just let the characters inform me who they are. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I do feel like usually I'm starting to see that my theme is always about hope.
That's
it's offering some kind of hope, but the real hope is in discovering what it means to be human. So just like you wrote the novel for young girls, right? And the issue of abortion, it's like we go back to saying nothing in life is black and white. There's no such thing as you know, all good or all bad. There are all good acts and all bad acts. We know that. But that there's always a hope in discovering the humanity in a situation. So maybe even the writing of your novel can help someone who is anti-choice understand on some kind of level that it's important to have choice.
And that was part of my goal.
It's always about offering perspective, just offering, like, I write about deeply flawed people who somehow wind up becoming just a little bit better.
And you know, it's funny because when you said the people that you write about, or the themes that you focus on, like hope, I think for the most part, I have four books out, but at least two of them deal with teen sex. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's funny because the reason I started watching Days of Our Lives in the first place was because of a scene that caught my attention when I was 9 years old about a teenage girl losing her virginity. And it was just so fascinating to me. And even though I was nine and not at all interested in having sex, the idea of sex with young people, it was just, the house could have been on fire, and I don't think I would have left because I was riveted. And so I like to focus on, I like to focus on female empowerment, and I like to focus on this taboo subject of teen sex, which makes it really difficult for me as a writer, because I have how do you get your book about teen sex and abortion in front of teenage girls? You can't go out in front of a school and hand out free copies, or you might get arrested or something. I don't know. Handing out pornography. They would call it pornography. But I totally know what you're talking about. Let me ask you this. Would you say would you identify as a feminist?
I always have. Yes, I have.
And how do you think that, who were your...
I read Joe in Little Women.
Oh, really? And so
I got to tell you, I was so disappointed with Jo's boys when she gave up her independence so she could run a home for boys for her husband. I was just like, you got to be kidding me. And then I only liked Jo in Little Women. Yeah. And because when I was growing up, thank goodness, it was the 70s.
Yes.
And Gloria Steinem and Helen Reddy Hear Me Roar. And I write about this all the time. I wanted to be Mary Tyler Moore. I wanted to, you know, move to a city, get my own apartment, and I never thought about getting married. Never, ever, ever. It didn't even occur to me. I wanted a career. I wanted to live in the world and be strong.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I was watching Mary Tyler Moore. I was watching Rhoda. I was watching, my favorite one is Lindsay Wagner, The Bionic Woman. I loved
Lindsay
The Bionic
Wagner's,
Woman.
Of course, ultimate.
Yeah. Just the ultimate. And you know, it's funny, I happened to see her one day at the Westwood Mall, and she was on the escalator and she had a bunch of kids with her. And I so desperately just wanted to thank her for her inspiration, but I decided to just not say anything because she had children with her and I didn't want to bother her. And occasionally when I used to live in Los Angeles and I would see famous people, there's certain famous people that I just love so much. And, you know, I'm so grateful for their creative influence and their creative input. Like, for instance, I was getting my hair done in Brentwood one time, just, you know, cut and everything. And so it was all wet. They had just washed it. And I was getting ready to move from the wash basin over to my main chair. And I saw Mick Fleetwood standing there. And I love Fleetwood Mac so much. And I just like walked up to him with the towel on my head. And I looked at him right in the eye. And I said, I love you, man. And then I went to my seat. And he looked like expressionless and stunned. And, you know, I didn't want to fawn all over him or make him feel embarrassed, but I really truly wanted him to know that I appreciated his work. And so when I saw Lindsay Wagner, I felt like, oh my God, I just want to tell her I love her. But, you know, I kept my mouth shut.
Well, I actually worked for Lindsay Wagner's publicist, so I met her.
Oh, really?
I used to work for a publicist. I did Bill Cosby's fan mail.
Oh, wow.
I answered it letter by letter on a typewriter, which lets you know that I am freaking old. But yeah, right, an IBM Select. Letter by letter. No, Mr. Cosby cannot give money for your kids' braces. No, Mr. Cosby. Everybody asked Mr. Cosby for money.
Really?
And Mr. Cosby never talked to me.
Interesting.
But Lindsay Wagner was very, really cool. And I also, even though she would stand at my desk, could not get up the nerve to say, oh my God, I love you so much. You really inspired me. I even, as such a little actor, artist, I loved that she had this little scar.
I have that scar. I have the same scar.
So do I now.
Really? Wow.
I don't. It's probably from all my years of chain smoking to try to stay thin for daytime television. I smoked 2 packs a day.
Wow.
And I ran 3 miles a day. And I exercised twice a day. You never know when you're going to have to put on a swimsuit, so you just got to be ready.
Right.
But it was the same for the men.
That's true.
It wasn't any easier for the guys.
No.
But the one time I'm thinking of, one time I was at a gig in Santa Monica, not performing, but watching, and to my right, I looked over and it was Sidney Poitier.
Oh, wow.
I almost fainted. There's no way you're talking to Sidney Poitier. He is royalty to me. He's beyond. Yeah, I couldn't say. No.
Well, you know, I got my scar because I hit my mouth on a piano like an old time record player when I was a little kid, and it just like ripped my lip open. So, Jamie Summers and I have the same scar.
What I was going to tell you is I tried to give myself that scar when I was young, and I said I really did. I would pick up my lip, but you know, that's crazy actor talk.
Yeah, us crazy actors. Well, let me ask you this. When you were out and about, and we'll get back to your writing in a minute, but when you were out and about as an actress, whether it was auditioning or sitting in agents' offices or whatever, I'm assuming you did, but did you experience sexism, and is there something you can share?
Yeah, there's subtle and then obvious, right?
Right.
And I have worked on both sides of the camera. I have been in casting. I've worked at a screen. Yeah, I've worked for producers. I worked for a production company at Fox. So as an actor, I would say the worst experience I had was with a very successful director who asked to take a meeting with me for a lead in a film. This was post Days of Our Lives. And his first question to me sitting on the sofa was, I'd love to find out when you lost your virginity. Which had nothing to do with the role. And I said, when did you lose yours?
Good answer.
And he sort of looked at me and he said, oh, you know, when I was a teenager. And I said, when I did is none of your effing business. And he thought that was great. He thought it showed like chutzpah, you know. I really do think that bullies like that, men who bully women in that sense, really love women who stand up like that. It's a twisted kind of thing.
Yes, I see what you mean, yeah.
It's twisted. So then I did get called in, and I was up for the role. And I read for his producers. It's a very big production company, Oscar award-winning films. I was not auditioning for an Oscar award-winning film. After the cast director called me and said that one of the producers really thought I was cute and wanted to take me to lunch. And I said, I was furious. And now I would probably just go to lunch.
Yeah.
But I was furious. I was so offended. And she said, you know, it's just lunch. And I said, I'm not a prostitute.
Ooh.
I was really, really mad. really mad. You know, I mean, now I understand it's like, it's necessary to go to lunch
right.
and build relationships with people. But back then I was very pure about, you know, it's the art. If they don't like me for my work, then it was really silly. I had a lot of...
But it's understandable because there's a lot of sexism out there and you don't know who you can necessarily trust. I mean, there was...
Well, it makes you feel vulnerable, definitely.
Yes,
so vulnerable.
You definitely
it's
feel
like
vulnerable.
I have to go to lunch and pretend like I like this person so I can get a job. That's in any industry,
yes,
though.
Yes, it is. It's absolutely in any industry.
It's just in life, whether or not you're male or female or, you know, even a female boss hiring someone might want to take you to lunch to see if you get along.
Yeah.
But I did finally wind up going out to eat with this producer, and I did not get the part. I went out to eat with him after they cast the film, and he said, you know, by the way, I gave the part to so-and-so because she did sleep with me.
Ugh.
And I just thought, well, you know, I mean, it's not the first time I've heard that story.
Yeah.
And poor her, not knowing that you're probably telling people that story. And, you know...
That's just so sickening. I mean,
I don't know. I don't see. Here's the interesting thing. So consenting adults agree to do things, to work. What I don't know. But I definitely have seen much worse on the other side of the camera in the producer's room mm-hmm. with men, you know, turning to each other after an actress auditions and saying, you know, would you F her? On a scale of 1 to 10, would you F her? And if they don't all agree, then she doesn't get the part because yeah. they have to feel like they would want to have sex with her in order for her to get this lead. And maybe it's some sort of marketing, you know, I mean, movies are geared towards 18 to 35 year old men. I don't know. But as a woman, I just was so happy to, you know, so often I was even an agent for a year.
Hmm.
And I just felt like I just always wanted to just take a shower after meeting with... Now, there are a lot of really great men in Hollywood.
Yeah.
There are a lot of really great artists. But there were certain production companies that I just would leave and just wish I could just take a shower. I just felt sick at the way they talked about women. It was just sickening.
Yeah, I mean, I had an experience where, and I'm not going to name names either, but in the studio that I belonged to, there was a certain gentleman who would come in from time to time, and we all had a great rapport with him. He was an ex-member of the studio. He went on to have a very successful professional career, and the shows that he's worked on are very recognizable. And so it was around Christmas time and he, you know, had returned and we were having a Christmas party and he was there and we were all talking and I, being like the big mouth going off on whatever I am, was going off on the fact that there were no good men in LA, blah, 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 and blah, blah. So next thing I know, next day I get a call from him and he left a message for me and asked me to go out. Like for lunch or whatever it was, or dinner. And I immediately thought, oh my God, he wants to date me. And I didn't know, like, I thought, well, maybe he wants to interview me or talk to me about a role on his television show. And he was producing at the time and writing. So I called up my acting coach and I asked him his advice. He goes, well, if you don't want to go out with him, then don't go out with him. And so I was like, great. So, you know, I had to call him back and I asked him specifically, are you asking me out for personal or professional reasons? And he said personal. And I basically had to tell him I don't shit where I eat, which I didn't use those terms, but that's kind of what I said. And then that was that. And his whole demeanor toward me changed. And there was a scene that I had been doing from The Importance of Being Earnest, which at the time, I think I was like, I don't know, maybe 29, 28 years old. So I played Gwendolyn, and I was too old to play Gwendolyn, but I wasn't promoting this to casting directors or agents. It was just like a learning exercise to do this, to do this particular scene. And I was really good. It was one of the best things I'd ever done. And he happened to show up for one of the nights that I did this scene, and all he did was criticize me and say that I was too old. And, you know, he only had critical things to say, whereas everybody else And, you know, and I could feel that I was good. I mean, everybody else was telling me that, you know, I was outstanding at playing Gwendolyn and everything. So, you know, it's because I didn't go out with him personally, he used it against me. And then interestingly, years and years and years later, I did meet up with him for lunch, and I kind of brought this little episode up. And he specifically told me that no matter what, he was never going to cast me on his show. And it was like, okay, I see you're still a little bitter. Whatever. It's like that. I mean, that I'm so glad to be out of Hollywood. And I love writing, and I love, you know, sometimes I get lost in the blogging, because that's something that I do more for a living and more as an activist. But I absolutely love writing the books and being creative. And I don't know, personally, I don't know what my next book is going to be. But what about you? What are you working on right now?
I'm actually working on a collection of essays. I just discovered, you know, the personal essay is huge now, I know. Personal essay and memoir. Mm-hmm. And it's so funny, right before I met my fiancé, I was getting ready to start. I wanted to start a storytelling night, mm-hmm. In LA called Singalandia, True Stories from the Lone States. I have worked as a ghostwriter the last 6 years and also helping artists develop their voice, their brand, right? And I realized that I was doing this for everybody but myself. And my clients were very successful. So I thought, you know, what is my brand? What makes me unique, you know, different from everyone? And it's that I've never lived with a man and I've never been married. And I thought, oh, I am terminally single. So I started working on these essays about being single. Always the Drunken Bridesmaid that I referred to earlier was one of them. I have quite a few of them. And then I met Larry and realized for the first time in my life I wanted to be married at the age of 50. And so, and I had been promoting Singalandia, but a book came out at the same time. I wrote a series of essays for the book, but a book came out at the same time called Spinster. And it made the New York Times bestseller list. And I sort of went, oh, and I sort of, so other agents were like, oh, there's already a book out like this. We don't want to promote it anymore. So now my collection of essays is called True North. And it includes essays from Singalandia. And it's all about how, you know, the journey toward becoming isn't a straight line. It's all about how all the experiences that I have had have turned me into a person who can actually add value and really enjoy this whole new place in my life. I've been through the foster to adopt system to be a parent, and that did not work out. I've had all these experiences, and now, you know, and then at the age of 52, I got engaged and moved in with a man and his kid. I had a ready-made family. I have grandchildren. It's crazy. It's crazy.
Wow.
And I look back at all the experiences I had that made me become a person who could actually benefit this family and their own personal struggles. And it's so fascinating to me. So I want the stories in True North to sort of offer the idea that, you know, when you cast your boat off, you know, leaving Days of Our Lives and casting my boat off, I had no idea it was going to be such choppy seas. There were going to be really bad years, really broke years, really sick years. Like, life was going to be really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard. I mean, at one point, my Al-Anon sponsor said to me, if I had your life, I'd kill myself. It was that bad. I was like, oh, okay, it really is that bad. That's how I feel. I feel like it's like that bad. And so all of those experiences have made me now a person who can really like appreciate and love and be a good support to my new family. And it's really interesting. I do everything ass backwards.
And now you have to do it in a Donald Trump administration.
Well, we'll still see. We'll see about that.
Yeah, I know. I know.
This is the great thing that I think I told you I was just finished writing this essay for a parenting website called Giving Hope to Kids, Practicing Buddhism Post-Election. And I've really been, you know, as an almost life, as most of my adult life, I've practiced Buddhism. And I keep trying to, and I chant. So I keep trying to chant to bring forth the wisdom to offer hope to the kids in my house, mm-hmm. One of whom is gay, the other is a feminist. We were all so distraught, like yeah. we had been kicked in the gut. Mm-hmm. And not distraught about Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Distraught that so many people were willing to, were able to overlook the things that he had said about the about us.
Yeah.
And there was so much fear. It was very hard. And, for so many people. And I was writing about this fact that people say that, you know, that we have sour grapes or we cried because we didn't get the outcome that we wanted. Mm-hmm. I didn't feel this way when George Bush was elected. Mm-hmm. I miss George Bush right now so much, like I think we all do. I think that we would gladly have Mitt Romney as our president yes. right now. A lot of my friends, you know, I'm a white girl. So a lot of my friends of color, lesbian and gay friends are like, you know, welcome to our America, Stacey. Mm-hmm. Now you finally see, right? Mm-hmm. And I think more than anything, you know, my question I just continue to have with relatives and friends who voted for Trump was to try to understand. So don't you have daughters? Don't you have gay sons you love? What do you tell your children about? I had a friend recently whose parents said to him, he's gay and they voted for Trump. They crossed party lines for the first time to vote for Trump. And he was devastated as a gay man. And they said to him, you know what? This election, money was just more important.
Yeah.
So I understand that, you know, tell me if I'm talking too long. Here's my thing. I understand that as human beings, psychologically, we all compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. I am not always a good person either. I don't always like people or try that hard to understand where someone's coming from. But even when I was ass broke and sick and turned 40 in my parents' unfinished basement in Colorado, not once did I blame George Bush.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand I'm trying to, you know, so many things have gone into creating the economic situation in the Rust Belt. Manufacturing jobs, they are not going to come back. And unions and all kinds of, it's so complex. Mm-hmm. And I just think that the crazy voices of hate and division have become so loud. And this didn't happen in a vacuum. I can't put my brain around it, but all I can do is say that as a Buddhist, the hope continues to be that your environment is a reflection of some aspect of your life. Human beings created this, mm-hmm. so human beings can change it. Mm-hmm. So how do I become a person who is willing to fight her own inner weaknesses to not have dialogue? You know, my refusal to have dialogue with people who think differently. How do I stop stereotyping people? And, you know, it's like I was saying as a writer, like, you know, how do I discover the humanity in a really flawed character? Mm-hmm. How do I find the humanity in a person who doesn't mind that Donald Trump said that my friends from Mexico are rapists?
Yeah, you know, not
a
easy.
Lot of people, a lot of people just think he didn't mean what he said. He didn't, Stacey, he didn't mean what he said.
Yeah.
And I need this and this and this and my, you know. So I it's happened. The poison has come to the surface. In Buddhism, we say take poison, make of a medicine. Mm-hmm. I see the people around me getting more politically active than I've ever seen
them.
That's
true. That is a positive.
It has
that's
deepened,
coming.
Like the young gay man in my house, his determination to work for gay rights has deepened.
Yeah.
He was a volunteer coordinator in a phone bank for Hillary, and this was his first big action as a young person, and he was heartbroken. But he has made Obama his mentor. So it's like he found a mentor. He's going to follow his lead. He is, you know, talking to other young gay people about how to move forward. The young feminist in my house is protesting, making T-shirts, talking to girls. She just got into an amazing liberal arts all-female college. It's like we don't have to worry. We just have to keep taking action. Like, we have to sink our roots deeper. I don't know if I'm offering any suggestions. I'm rambling.
Well, no, I mean, we all have our own way of viewing this and our own perspective. And I think it's really good to hear other people's perspective. Because, you know, I mean, as an online activist, I'm getting a lot of emails from people, messages, Facebook messages, you know, desperately asking me, what can I do? Where's the hope? So what I would like to say
is we can change ourselves.
We can change ourselves and we can listen to other people. And I think we have to be informed. And, you know,
we have to stand up for justice. You cannot build your happiness on the suffering of others. That is not real happiness.
Right.
So we cannot take away gay rights. We cannot take away women's rights. But we can work to equalize other people's rights. But we have to stand up for justice. As far as I feel, you know, growing up in the wilderness, and most of my novels are about environmental action and protecting Mother Earth. We have to see that everything is interconnected. We can't pollute our water in the name of oil. Water is life. We have to work together to somehow, you know, find agreements. And that is the history of man. That is the history of mankind.
Yes. And you're absolutely right. And I think the most important point to take from this is that we all have to be unified. We all have to stand against injustices and, you know, and support each other. I'm going to start wrapping this up, but I want you to stick around for my next segment and another thing. But why don't you tell everybody where to find you and where to find your work?
Well, right now, really the only place you can find me is because I'm rebooting. I'm doing a reboot, but, you can find links to my work, my writing and the coaching services I offer on, The Right Muse, WRITEMUSE.biz, therightmuse.biz.
Okay. Don't you have a Facebook page called The Right Muse?
I do.
Okay.
And I also have a, you know, you can go to stacygreason.com. It's a website that I had started called Late Bloomer, but it's not really going to move forward.
Okay. And well, your Facebook page is Stacy Greason. That's STACI.
Yes, but that's just a personal Facebook page.
Okay.
There's a fan page for Stacy Greason, but I don't run that fan page. So,
well, they can also find your book, The Last Great American Housewife.
It's still on Amazon.
So check it out.
But it was optioned for a film. I have finished the script.
Oh, wow. Congratulations. Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
I'm no longer with that production company, but my writing partner, Joey Gironda, and I are taking the script out. And we do have two pilots out there making the rounds right now, too. So
very cool. Well, thank you so much for
thank you, Kimberly,
being on the show. And stick around for End Another Thing.
So hard to handle. Sometimes I'm selfish and I'm sad. Now I've gone and lost the fist beat.